Hi, folks. This is the On Science podcast from NPR News. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer with the Science Desk. This week on the podcast, we'll see how advanced tornado technology could reduce deaths, and we'll survey the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, where workers are tackling the highly radioactive water that flooded the area. And we'll check in with a youth radio report that examines how advertisements affect our brains. But we'll start this week with owls. Despite two decades of work to bring them back, the spotted owls of the western United States are still on the decline, and they face a new threat, not from loggers this time, from another owl. Lauren Summer reports from member station KQED.
Northern spotted owls certainly love remote old-growth forest, but they also live right next to urban areas. National Park Service ecologist Bill Merkel is playing this recording of a spotted owl in hopes of hearing from a real one. It's almost dusk, and we're standing in a dense forest near Muir Woods, just north of San Francisco.
I think they're just probably like 50 or 60 feet up there.
Was that an owl?
That was an owl.
Merkel races up a steep slope that's covered in brush and poison oak. In the branches above him, he sees two spotted owls.
So this would definitely be a pair. They're hanging out together.
Northern spotted owls got famous in the 1990s when the federal government set aside millions of acres of forest to protect them. That stoked an epic battle between loggers and wildlife groups over their habitat. Since then, spotted owls haven't come back. And biologists believe that's due to this threat.
It's often described as, who cooks for you?
Who cooks for you, right?
That's David Press, another National Park Service ecologist. He's joining Merkel to look for the owl that makes that call, the barred owl.
You see anything from there?
They peer into a hollow high in a tree.
Just at the very base, you can see a little bit of that barred owl.
They're in the old spotted owl cavity.
Yeah.
Merkel looks concerned.
It's a troubling picture for the spotted owls.
Barred owls are an invader, originally from the eastern U.S. They first arrived in spotted owl territory in Washington decades ago, and Merkel says they've moved down the coast ever since.
The barred owl's a little larger, it's a little more aggressive.
Barred owls take over spotted owl territory, and in some cases, even attack them. Barred owls also have an advantage because they eat a wider variety of prey. In places like western Washington, the spotted owl population has been cut in half since the barred owl showed up. The Fish and Wildlife Service hopes to deal with this by taking a new approach.
Well, basically it means permanent removal.
Robin Bowne is a biologist with Fish and Wildlife.
We're going to look at all potential opportunities, but the most humane way to do it is to shoot them.
Bowne says they plan to eliminate barred owls from a few study areas to see if the spotted owls there do better. They also want to see if it's even feasible to remove barred owls by shooting them. And yes, Bowne says that will raise a few eyebrows.
It's a difficult concept to say, I'm going to kill one species to try to save another species. But it's also something that in some cases we need to do.
I think there's relatively little we can do about it.
Eric Forsman is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Forest Service. He says shooting owls isn't a long-term solution.
To try to control barred owls across a large region would be incredibly expensive, and you'd have to keep doing it forever, because if you ever stopped, they would begin to come back into those areas.
That's why Forsman says it's looking pretty dismal for the spotted owl.
I think all we can really do is try our best to provide habitat for spotted owls. In the long run, we're just going to have to let the two species work it out.
If approved, the barred owl removal study, a.k.a. owl shooting, would begin next year. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Summer in San Francisco.
Tornadoes have killed more than 530 people this year. Many scientists think that some of those deaths could have been prevented if the National Weather Service used more advanced detection and forecasting technology. NPR's John Hamilton reports on two efforts to improve the warnings of deadly weather.
On May 24th, a tornado touched down in central Oklahoma. KOFR-TV let people know.
There it is, tornado ground, 3 southwest of Chickasha. Chickasha, folks in Chickasha, you're out of time.
The tornado plowed through Chickasha and kept heading northeast at near freeway speed. A storm chaser caught it on videotape.
Here we are east of Chickasha on Highway 9. Massive tornado on the ground.
The National Weather Service was also tracking the twister with radar, which uses bursts of radio waves to gauge the shape, power, and direction of a storm. The Weather Service radar showed this tornado would cross the southern part of Newcastle, about 25 miles up Interstate 44. So officials sent emergency crews to that part of the city. But by chance, the storm was also being tracked by a separate experimental radar system designed to give more precise information. Brenda Phillips is part of the group that's been testing the system. She says as the tornado approached Newcastle, the city's emergency manager was looking at data from their radar.
And based on that data, he could see that the tornado was actually taking a turn to the north. And so with that, he was able to redeploy these first responders who were able then to get to the impacted area more quickly.
It was a big success for the group known as CASA, which was founded by several universities to improve weather radar systems. Michael Zink is at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Zink says that during the Oklahoma tornado, the experimental radars did a better job than traditional radars because they were able to provide a fresh image of the storm every minute.
The problem is that with the existing system, you only get 5-minute updates, and fast-moving weather events like tornadoes can change.
The existing system consists of about 150 massive radar antennas spread across the country. They sit on dedicated towers several stories high and can track storms that are more than 100 miles away. CASA wants to augment the existing system with lots of smaller radar antennas attached to buildings or cell phone towers. These new radars would provide more frequent updates. They would also offer a better view of the part of the storm that's near the ground. Zink says you need lots of radars to do that because the radio waves they use travel in a straight line.
And the Earth is round, as we all know.
As a result, the curvature of the Earth blocks a radar's view of anything that's far away and low to the ground. Zink says that means Weather Service radars have a big blind spot.
So roughly 75% of the atmosphere below 1 kilometer are not covered by these radars. And that's an area where a lot of the weather is happening. And we are thinking of using our systems to fill these gaps to have better weather observations.
And perhaps give people a few extra minutes' notice that a tornado is coming. A better radar system is just one way new technology could help people protect themselves from extreme weather. Another approach involves an alternative to weather balloons. Right now, the Weather Service launches 69 of these balloons twice a day around the country. Each balloon carries sensors that send back information about temperature, humidity, barometric pressure, and winds, stuff that helps forecasters predict when tornadoes are likely to appear. Bruce Lev is part of a company called AirDat that says the 69 weather balloons just don't provide enough data for really good forecasting.
The solution is to essentially make aircraft, commercial aircraft, into flying balloons.
Instead of dangling sensors from balloons, he says, AirDat has attached them to more than 200 planes.
If you look at the nose of an aircraft, it's one of those little tubes or blades that sort of sticks out from the front portion of the airplane.
A box inside the plane collects the information and sends it to a supercomputer. Lev says the system already gathers more than 15 times as much data as the nation's weather balloons. And he says the new technology proved itself in the days before a tornado devastated Joplin, Missouri in April.
Our forecasts were seeing severe rotation. We're seeing substantial supercell activity in and around Joplin, Missouri, 57 hours or more ahead of the tornadoes actually touching down.
The National Weather Service buys a small amount of data from AirDat. Scientists say there's little doubt that new technology could improve forecasting and detection of extreme weather. But Roger Pilkey Jr. from the University of Colorado Boulder says it's not clear how many lives that would save.
If you look at where people die from tornadoes, it's often in weakly constructed homes. And it's not that they didn't know that there was a storm bearing down on them. It's that they didn't have any options.
Or they did have options, but made a bad decision. And no technology can prevent that. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Earlier this week, at the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan, workers tested out a system that will start cleaning up radioactive water. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, the water has flooded many buildings at the complex, and it has seriously complicated efforts to bring the crisis there to an end.
The utility in Japan has been pumping water continuously into the crippled nuclear plant since the tsunami knocked out the system that was supposed to keep the reactor cores from overheating. The result is that there's now enough radioactive water there to fill something like 40 Olympic swimming pools.
You have this large amount of contaminated water, which is a good thing.
Yes, Per Peterson, chair of nuclear engineering at UC Berkeley, says it's a good thing to have all that water flooding the reactor buildings if you consider what could have happened instead.
Most of the radioactive material that was released from the damaged fuel was actually washed out into this water instead of going out into the environment, and that's good.
But it's also a huge problem when it comes to cleaning up the plant, because the radioactive water keeps workers at bay. So, the Japanese utility hired several companies to build a water decontamination plant. They're hoping the plant will be fully operational later this week. The challenge is to remove radioactive cesium and other elements that are dissolved in the water. The water is being pumped from the flooded basements into holding tanks. From those tanks, it will go through a filtration system, something like a charcoal filter, that captures some of the radioactive material. Next, the water will run into a system built by the French nuclear company Areva. Spokesman Jared Adams explains that they use a chemical reaction to turn dissolved cesium into a solid material.
In our step of the process, the radioactive material precipitates out like rain and settles in the bottom of the tanks, where it forms a radioactive sludge. And that sludge can be removed from the tanks and then sent for long-term storage.
They use this process at other nuclear facilities, Adams says, and it works quite well.
We can reduce the radioactivity of the contaminated water by a factor of at least 1,000. So it will be significantly less radioactive than it was coming in.
Cleaning up all this water is likely to take a couple of months. If the water is clean enough, Japanese officials could decide to dump some of it into the ocean. But in the short term, they plan to run it back into the plant. That will keep the cores relatively cool, and as long as they stay cool, they won't ooze more radioactive cesium into the water.
I think this is an important step forward, because once they begin treating this water, then they'll be able to get into the plant and start doing significant repairs.
And one of the most important repair jobs will be to stop the reactor vessels from leaking water. Those leaks mean the utility has to keep pumping more and more water into the reactors to keep them cool. Per Peterson from Berkeley says several ideas are in play to plug the leaks.
One of the ones has been suggested is to literally fill the space between that containment vessel and the building walls with cement or grout. It's possible that one might also be able, using robots, to get in and patch places where the leaks are occurring as well.
Once the leaks are patched, the utility can fill the 3 damaged reactor vessels completely with water without flooding the rest of the plant. That would not only keep the reactor cores cool, but water, clean water that is, works as an effective radiation shield. In fact, Peterson says a water shield proved to be key to cleaning up the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown in Pennsylvania back in 1979.
It was possible to remove the fuel because you could flood water up above the level of the fuel, provide shielding, and then workers could actually get in to manipulate damaged fuel and get it out.
Eventually, they'll need to do the same thing at Fukushima Daiichi, though, like Three Mile Island, the process is likely to take many years. Richard Harris, NPR News.
For decades, social scientists have tried to determine how TV ads affect the children and teenagers who watch them. Do commercials make kids more materialistic? Are fast food ads responsible for rising childhood obesity rates? Well, youth radio reporter Maya Cueva looked for answers inside her own brain.
Here I am at Walgreens in the hair product aisle. There are a lot of brand name shampoos on the shelf, but there's one that always catches my eye.
For stylized curls that look like a splurge at a price that feels like a steal. Tresemme Flawless Curls.
I've probably seen this ad 100 times and didn't think it could affect me. Not after all my mom has taught me about never surrendering to the manipulative ways of advertising.
I realized that kids were living in a whole nother world that was influencing them more than I was.
My mom's a therapist. When I was in second grade, she started an after-school class where she had kids analyze TV shows and commercials.
And the kids were used to just going into that zone where you just kind of stop thinking and you just watch. And so this interrupted that and made people stop watching and start thinking.
But recently, I've been wondering just how much control I have over my own thoughts when it comes to ads, which is how I found myself in a Berkeley lab with a hat of electrodes on my head.
So this is called an EEG cap. I'm going to place one of these caps on your head.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, it looks like a swim cap. And then there's like a wire attached to my nose. I'm in the corporate headquarters of Neurofocus, a pioneer in the business of neuromarketing. It makes some scientists antsy, but the company claims to tell advertisers how to make better commercials by replacing focus groups with an electroencephalogram. Kind of like how a microphone is picking up the sound waves of my voice, the EEG strapped to my head is picking up brain waves created by the electrical activity that passes between neurons when my brain processes something. Anything. Even commercials. Like this one Neurofocus uses to demo their technology.
The Olympic Winter Games will always be where history happens.
As Morgan Freeman's godlike voice narrates, I watch images of a torch lighting ceremony, a figure skater, hockey players. Meanwhile, in a neighboring control room, lab director Mark Kishiyama shows my producer a series of squiggly waves that appear on a screen.
This is her brain activity right now, real time.
Visa, the only card accepted at the Olympic Games.
When you're watching ads and so forth, you know, you're kind of sitting there and you're kind of passively watching it, but your brain is responding to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always conscious. It's not conscious that you're...
Subconscious.
It is, or as we say non-conscious, but the awareness is still there.
That awareness shows up on the EEG as tall peaks in the parts of my brain Kishiyama says are associated with emotion, attention, and memory. Those parts get busy at certain moments in the ad, at the beginning with the torch and figure skater, and then later when a Visa card appears on screen. He says it's evidence that my brain is making a non-conscious link between the credit card and the Olympics.
You think that a 30-second ad is so fast none of it's going to get in, but it does, you know, as you can see.
So scary.
Does show how effective it is.
Advertisers will use Kishiyama's data on the most effective moments in an ad to compress it down to a 10-second web video for sites like YouTube. In theory, you'd see a lot more brainwave peaks per second as they pack this message into your head. But what happens once it's in there? Ben Hayden is a neuroscientist who studies decision-making. He told me about researchers at Caltech who scan the brains of people on diets while offering them junk food.
And you can literally witness this battle going on.
A certain region of the brain lit up when the dieters resisted the junk food. Hayden says that self-control region is in a tug of war with the parts of the brain affected by ads.
When advertising comes into the picture, it kind of is the opposite of self-control. It encourages you to go out and buy it, just do it.
If he scanned my brain while I was in that shampoo aisle, Hayden says he would see lots of activity in the just do it region as I grabbed the Tresemme. But just as TV ads prime that part of the brain, it turns out the kind of training my mom gave me could boost the signal in the just say no region. It's what mom was telling me all along.
So I wouldn't worry so much about whether your brain will react. It's more what decisions you make after your brain reacts.
So you think that I still could consciously not buy the product? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think so, because I know how thoughtful you are and how well-educated you are about this.
Okay, so maybe my mom's biased. But there's some neuroscience to back her up. Hayden says I could be better off than most teens because every time I think critically about how ads work, I create new patterns in my brain that strengthen the self-control regions. The ads might get inside my brain, but they don't have to decide what I do. For NPR News, I'm Maya Cueva.
And that's it for On Science from NPR News. You can find these stories and all of the coverage from the Science Desk at NPR at our website. That's npr.org/science.